My name is Paul McKee, and I'm an alcoholic. Boy, what a lot of pretty faces out there. There certainly is. Good to see you all here, too. Because of my age and all, I can't remember when Daryl and I got together. But there was probably not any different than a lot of us. Certainly not any different than me. When I got into AA, I was all hat and no cattle. And because that's a pretty empty type of place to be. It truly is. Daryl and I can remember we got together from, we had a little retreat called Rock Eagle. And I really forget all the particulars, but we sat down and just started to talk. And that was the start of one just beautiful, beautiful relationship from my point of view. This guy's done everything he's been asked to do. He takes his inventory, and then he tells someone about it. He calls me every day. And he follows that, which is in the 12 and 12, where it says, meditation and prayer, and examination, just taking one, will get as good for us. But taken together makes it an unshakable foundation for life. And that's where my friend is working on. Thank you so much.
Wow, I think I want to listen to him for a while. Again. I'm Daryl, and I'm an alcoholic. And only by the grace of God in this fellowship am I alive and sober today. And I am so grateful for that. Paul walked into my life, and, you know, when I first got here, you people said, you've got to get a sponsor, you've got to get a sponsor. And I was like, nah, I'll do this alone. And you'll see in my story, I tried to do it alone a little bit, and it never worked. But I do believe in God puts the right people in our right paths for a reason. And every one of my sponsorships that I've gotten a great deal out of, those people were always just founded. It wasn't like I went and picked them. They just came. And that's what happened with me and Paul at Rock Eagle. I just said, I need to know that guy. And I sat and talked with him and spilled my guts to him. And then now I do it weekly. It's a fantastic thing. We have coffee and everything. At 8 years old, I woke up. And we had this little cylinder light above our beds, and me and my sister. And I was looking up at the light when I got woken up by my sister, and I was like, what? What's going on? And I saw smoke, and I was like, wow, that's a trip. I'm eight, I'm thinking fire, you know, ready to flip out and jump through the window. And my sister wakes me up, and she goes, there's a fire, we need to get out. And I was like, oh my God. So her and I go to the edge of the stairwell, and this is up in New Jersey, and don't hold that against me. Came to the top of the stairs, and there were flames shooting up through the banister. So we basically put our backs against the wall in our pajamas, scaling this wall to keep away from this fire. And there was this huge, ugly, retro 70s chair on fire, blazing. And me and my sister were like dumbfounded, and we did not know where my mother was. My dad, he was in and out of our lives a lot. He was one of us too, and you'll see he comes back in my life later on. And we go to wake up my mother, and she's passed out. Oblivion, to the point of no return, and we just keep trying to wake her and wake her. And this is an 8-year-old and a 10-year-old. Trying to get through this fear of this fire blazing in the living room, and we could not wake this woman up. And so we end up taking pots and pans of water and putting out this blaze. The next thing I remember was the next morning, me and my dad, he returned from wherever he was, probably parked on the wrong side of the street, going the wrong way type of thing, because that was pretty normal in our household. But we took this burned up chair and put it out curbside because we had garbage pickup, and for weeks it sat there until the garbage man picked it up, and I never felt so ashamed of my family and this disease than that day. And that was my first experience with alcoholism. I already knew I was powerless over this thing. And I definitely knew the unmanageability at such a young age, watching my mother go through this. Now, if you were to walk past my house when I was a youngster, you'd see glass breaking, garbage cans being thrown. If it was up to me, I would have just wrote, "Alcoholics live here," on the side of the house, because the cops would always come by. There'd always be a loud racket, people yelling, screaming. And you know what? I thought that that was a normal way of life. I thought that running for an escape, looking for an escape, was a normal affair. And, you know, later on, I found that escape in a bottle. But during my childhood, I was constantly hiding from this alcoholism, over and over and over again. And if you look at really where I came from, I got a sense of ease and comfort from hiding and from escape. And I believe it today to be true that I found that escape in a bottle later on. Now, if you fast forward into Daryl's grown-up life, when I was 24, I decided to drink double-fisted. You know what that is, right? Really? Double-fisted all day from 11 a.m. to 2 o'clock in the morning in Orlando, Florida, and I was going to drive home that day. Why not? I deserve it. I got a car. I'm going to go. It's time to go. How we do it. And I decided on the bottom of a hill. First of all, I took this route home because I knew the cops wouldn't be there. Like, that really mattered at this point. But so I drive over this hill and I smash into this dump truck. And the clincher is I'm going to tell you stories just for the insanity sake of it, because it's a reality for me that I kept this way of life, and I kept thinking that this was going to get better, and it never did. And so I smashed into this truck. They do a field sobriety test. My truck is destroyed. I go up to the side of the car and I'm leaning on it, and I remember in the police report it said he was so drunk he leaned on the car. I fought that in court and said that I was full of terror and fear because I had just been in an automobile accident. Poor Daryl. I went to court that day. It was so funny, sort of. I stayed up all night drinking the day before this DUI case came up. And little glitches of what happened and what occurred that night came to my mind as I drove almost late to the court hearing. And they didn't do a breathalyzer at the scene of the accident because my mouth was bleeding. So what I thought, when I was sitting there, they did the field sobriety. I don't know why they did this too. They took me to an internal police field sobriety center where they actually have you walk the line and film you. I have no idea why they did that, and who cares by this point, but I was sitting there, and the girl said, "You know what? You know why we couldn't do a breathalyzer, or maybe we can. Let's see how bad his mouth is cut." As soon as I heard her do that, I started to chew on the inside of my mouth so it would bleed more, just so you couldn't get me. So I go to court that day. I walk into the courtroom, and the defense attorney comes up to my lawyer comes walking back to me, and I'm like, oh, great, you know, I just want to get through this, give me the fine, whatever. And he says, have you been drinking this morning? And I was like, no. I'm a chef, so I stay up late and we party a lot. So that's why I smell like that. But who in their right mind goes to a DUI hearing half-cropped? This alcoholic. There was a hit and run at 2 o'clock in the afternoon up in Dunwoody, so I decided to drive out of this restaurant at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, drunk as a skunk, smash into a car on the road, and I back up and go home. I was oblivious to what was actually occurring. And these young ladies, one of them gets hurt. There's three girls in the car. One of them gets hurt. And they decide to follow me and call the cops, right? But who in their right mind makes... I kept stopping at the lights and putting on my blinker, according to the report. The cop was like, what's wrong with you? You know? I know you're drunk, but why are you stopping and doing... So, I remember I get to my apartment, I take off my shirt, I start cooking myself a little dinner, and I'm like, who could that be? And the cop's like, is that your Eclipse out front? And I'm like, no, I drive a Subaru. He's like, why don't you put on your shirt, turn off that burner, and if the oven's on, turn that off. And why don't you come with me? Then the last time that I was going to do this deal, I swore to myself over and over again, I'm not going to do this today. I'm not going to do what I did last night. I'm not going to do what I did last week. That's it. I'm through with this junk again. So my buddy calls and he says, hey, want to go out for some beers? Now, this was the cat that always seemed to get away with, like, I would crash into a tree and five cops would surround me, and he would go home and we would drink the same amount. This was the guy that always seemed to make it through. And he says, hey, you want to go out for a drink? I'm like, nope, that's it. I'm done. I'm done again. He's like, again? Okay, good. I'll call you back, and we'll see what you're up to. And he calls me back. Want to go out for a drink? All right. Two. I did. I said that. I said, two. So he says, where are we going to go? I said, I'm not going out to the big places that we always do where I get really out of control and insane. I want to keep this low key, so let's go to the Mexican place. It was down the block, and it was... really couldn't get a DUI in a quarter of a mile, you would think. But there was only one reason why this alcoholic was looking to go to the Mexican place, and that was because I was going to have two, right? They have those big-ass beers that are 32 ounces, and I knew in my heart of hearts that, A, I couldn't have two, and God forbid it was 6 or 8 ounces. I was not going to do that. If I was going to do it, it would be with a big hammer. So I'm driving home that night, wrong side of the road, woken up in a blackout, blue lights, and I have no idea where I am. No idea. I see the blue lights, I'm like, oh no. But there was something in my heart, the pit of my stomach, that dropped to the ground. And I think that was surrender. I think I finally knew this gig was up. So the cops pulled me out of the car, put my arms behind my back, but I knew in my soul of souls that this gig was up. I don't know what it takes to surrender and how and why, but I can tell you I can actually say that I could feel that feeling again if I wanted to. but I knew in my soul that this gig was up. So I got put in jail for 18 hours. Long story short, the guys throw me the jumpsuit, and all of a sudden my name's called on the loudspeaker, and I'm not going to general public or whatever. I was like, whoa, now this is a God deal. So we go, me and my buddy, we're driving home, and the first thing that I want is a drink. I deserve it. I slept on a concrete floor with a bunch of people I didn't know. They kept waking me up. It made me sick. Their food made me sick. I can't stand it. Poor me. Woe is me. Give me a drink. So I said, let's stop at the Circle K. So we stopped by the Circle K. I grabbed 2 12-packs, my favorite. And I'm walking out, and the arresting officer is getting in his car. And he's facing me. So he's like getting into his car. And he looks at me like, wow, you poor guy. I mean, he didn't look at me like, you disgrace, I'll get you again, ha ha, you know. He looked at me, I could look at his face again today and tell you exactly what he looked like. And he looked at me with a form of disgrace that I've never seen before in a human's face. And he just gently rose his hand and said, see you later. And I'll never forget that. For me, that's what surrender felt like. That's what step one felt like. When my life had completely gotten unmanageable, I got that part. But the powerlessness, I finally decided to understand that part. That took a lot of me doing too. So I get the best lawyer in the house for this deal, right? His name was Bubba, and I'm not kidding, and he was a brick house. He was huge. He says, you know what, man? I think you drink too much. I was like, you just want my money. So he goes, I got a suggestion for you. Go to this 12-week program and show them that you know you have a problem, whether you think it or not. And so I cussed him out. I thought, wow, you know, you got no right to tell me that. And I'm sure you guys just want my money. More money, more money. And I'm telling I talked to my dad on the phone at this point. My dad's 15 years sober. And I said, Dad, these guys want my money. Can you believe that they want me to go to this 12-week program? He says, I think you might want to listen. He didn't probe me. He didn't push me. And by the way, he had been walking this walk for that whole time before I decided to surrender. So I go to this 12-week counselor deal, and the guy sits me down with this pop quiz, and it's like 100 questions, multiple choice, on whether I'm an alcoholic or not. And I lied my butt off. If they said, do you drink 2 to 4 beers, 6 to 8, 12 to 20, I'd put 2 to 3. Whatever they said, I would answer the opposite. And the guy sits me down and says, Mr. Stark, I believe, and from what the results of this test say, that we believe you're 90% alcoholic. And I was like, you have got to be kidding me. I just lied my teeth off for this thing. And you guys still want my money. So seriously, I went into this 12-week program, and that's when the discovery happened. I hated it. I hated sitting around with these people telling me their problems. And I didn't think I was even closely, remotely related to any of them. But there was a point in 12 weeks that I finally figured it out, that I have the disease of alcoholism. See, one of the biggest things that I didn't know coming in here was I wasn't educated about alcoholism. I didn't know a thing. I knew my mother had it. I knew my dad had it. My grandmother had it. I knew I was pitching a double hitter, I got it. But I didn't get this disease, and I didn't realize how powerful it was until these people sat around. We did this little corny exercise where they sit around and they pretend they're interviewing you for whatever, TV or whatever. And so they all start going around and they keep hitting me with these questions that are alcohol related, and all of a sudden the place got real cloudy and light with me and I felt all alone. And as the questions kept proceeding, I kept getting lower and lower, because all I could do was answer yes. So I finally looked at these people and said, you know what, I am an alcoholic. I get it now. Once I came to believe, once I understood what you all were talking about, I got the insanity part, but I didn't know about this coming to believe business. And, you know, that's where prayer started to be talked about with me as an alcoholic and all that stuff. And when you guys said the Lord's Prayer the first time, I didn't know the words, and I'm not kidding. I really didn't. And the Serenity Prayer was the first and probably one of the best assets to my arsenal of prayer today. But I'll read this to you. In the big book, in the 12 and 12, it says, they flatly declare that since they have come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power and to do certain simple things, there has been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. When I heard that, I was like, wow, these people are on to something. They really are. They're on to something really big and good. So I end up sort of going through this spiritual awakening you guys kept describing and the book said something about. And I was like, okay, so what does this look like to me? Pixie dust, flares, I mean, something big's got to happen for me. And, you know, the biggest spiritual awakening that I ever had was when the obsession of alcohol was lifted from me. And I can't tell you what day or time or what evening it was or how many hours I had sober. I just knew that that obsession went away and I didn't do it. So what you guys kept pausing me on was actually a reality. And I started to come to believe. When my second spiritual awakening, and people usually get a kick out of this, was when I went from my apartment to the dumpster with my garbage from the week before, and it didn't clink or clank. I was like, wow, this sobriety thing is really, I'm getting good now. Life is becoming something. I don't have to use as many garbage bags, and I'm not embarrassed carrying it. Wow, what a great program. So I go to this mailbox, and I go to check my mail, and I got bills out the yin yang. All right, I got a DUI hit and run, a second DUI, and a lot of other problems financially going on, and I'm looking at my stack. And this old man comes up to me and goes, you know what? And I said, no, and I don't care. I'm about 90 days sober. And I'm thinking, nobody should bother me right now. Don't you understand who I am, man? Obviously, he didn't. So he keeps talking to me, and he goes, you know what? This bluebird is, you see that tree? This bluebird's going to come up, and he's going to stick his beak in the bark, and it's going to strain the sap, and he's going to leave, and another bird's going to come drink the sap. It's amazing. I was like, what? I'm like, I don't want to sponsor. I don't want to go to these meetings. I don't want to talk to anybody. Dude, leave me alone. You know what I mean? I was so pissed off from you guys taking away my alcohol. I didn't want to talk or see a thing. And sure enough, he goes, look. And it happened. I was like, oh my God. But check this out. That put an imprint in my sobriety for the rest of my entire sobriety. I guarantee you. At this point, I started to see this slow process sort of happening, but And it talks about in the 12 and 12 how we take, the sponsor says to the sponsee how he's taken step two piecemeal himself. And that's really been my experience with it, that it's been an ongoing journey to believe and to understand my insanity. Also has been a hell of awakening for me as well. But I started to see the patterns of my life and my crazy way of life, and my sponsor started to point that out to me. This guy was 84 at the time, and I was 20-something. His name is Papa Billy. He lives on the north end of the city. And so we're working the steps, and we're on step three, and I'm like, really? A decision to who? You know, I'm thinking, I'm not on this God track yet. You know, leave me alone about this. And he says to me, listen, we need to do the third step prayer. So what we're going to do is get on our knees, hold our hands together, and say the third step prayer. And I was like, is it too close, too far, too last? Keep that. He says to me, he goes, okay, so let's go say the prayer in my room. And I was like, what room? He's like, my bedroom. I was like, I don't think so, dude. I don't know what kind of praying you want to do, but I'm not taking part. And this sweet old man is just like, shut up and come with me. And so we held hands. We crouched down to the edge of the bed. And we said this prayer. And for the first time in my life, I felt the Spirit of God enter my heart. And I'll never forget that. And it, as if it's such a zany story, why shouldn't it be for this alcoholic? So I got the opportunity to do this step with other gentlemen. And I never invited him to my room that way. So I was like, okay, church, you know. But I took this guy over to this church one day, and his name was Matt, and he was such a great, great guy, and he was getting a program, and we moved on to step three. And I am not kidding. We went to this yard at this church, and there was this concrete bench, and we knelt next to it. We put our hands together, and we were about to recite the prayer, and we looked up, and there was a cross. And I don't know if he saw the cross before we sat there, but I did not. And again, this program decides to touch my spirit internally that I can never, ever forget. And I don't know whatever happened to Matt, to be honest with you. But I guarantee you, he knows what that feeling felt like that I felt for my sponsor beforehand. And that's what the magic is about this deal. It's not about crowded rooms and crowded people with a bunch of drinks. It's about one alcoholic speaking to another. On Christmas Eve one year, I went to a meeting and I didn't want to go. I think it was my first year in sobriety. I had to get a ride, blah, 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 because, you know, the courts would take your car if you keep running into things. And I go to this meeting, and I had this other sponsor, Owen, and I said, I was pissed off. I was going to this meeting Christmas Eve. Oh, you know, what else did I have to do on Christmas Eve? There's got to be something better. So, drink. And so I go to this meeting, and I walk up, and it starts at 8, and it's like 2 minutes to 8. Nobody's in there. I'm like, cool, I'm out. My sponsor walks up. I'm like, I did not know you were coming here. He's like, I didn't know you were coming here either. I don't want to talk to you either. No, I'm just kidding. But so we waited 5 minutes, and nobody came down. And this was at Peachford, where you get to wear a little badge that says visitor, and it's very cool. He ended up, I said, you know, nobody's showing up. We might as well split. And he said, no, no, no. All it takes is two alcoholics. I was like, okay. So these three guys come down, starry-eyed, red-faced, you know the look. And
we had a meeting with these guys. And one of the guys came up to us and said, this is probably the best gift they ever received on Christmas. And I was like, wow. You know, that's what this program's all about. I believe, I'll give you something that I'd like to sort of close up on, but you know, there's a lot of tools in this program that work, and I went through a rotten year on some real life problems, and step 5 changed my life and step 10 changed my life, and that was only because of the sponsorship that I keep. And I'm not just talking about Mr. Wonderful over here, but I'm also talking about I have 5 other guys in my network, including my father, that are a substantial part of my network, who I constantly reveal more to them, and I constantly get feedback about these life issues that Daryl, his ego and his pride, decide that they can handle on their own. And it says something about I read this thing, it said, you know, God doesn't need to hear it as much as you need to say it. And I always constantly try to reveal more to people around me, because I think that's where the promises hold. I'm going to tell you one last story and then I'm going to close it up. But when I came to my 9th step, I thought, and I might be the only one that thought of this, but I thought, I'm going to make amends to these people. And they're going to come back to me and go, we love you. Thank you so much for getting sober. So there was this girl named Laura, who, if you look in the big book, it talks about the roaring tornado. That was me. Poor little Laura was in my path, and I swept her up and damaged her whole life, probably for a long, long, very long time. And so it was amends time, and so we couldn't find Laura, so I found 3 addresses. One was her parents' address, and 2 were ones that we thought she lived near or in Illinois. So I wrote an amends letter, and we articulated it. We went through it over and over and over again, me and my sponsor, and we finally sent it. So every night when I came back from my meetings, because I was doing 90-90 or whatever, I would look at the answering machine being like, she didn't call yet. She didn't call yet. This is about me. She didn't call yet. Where's my accolades? So I come back. I am not kidding. Every meeting I would come home and, man, it's not flashing. So I came home one night from a meeting and it was flashing. I was like, ah! Took her some time, but she came around. And sure enough, the light was blinking. I pressed the message and this lady says, hey, my name's Laura. I'm not the Laura you're looking for, but I want to tell you I got your letter. I was like, huh. My husband died from alcoholism 2 years ago, and I only pray that he would have the opportunity that you have right now and what you're doing in your recovery, and I love you and take care of yourself. Goodbye. So, the story is disclosed, right? Daryl's making it all about him. Daryl thinks the 9th step is about him. And here comes God with a big shove in the face for Daryl once again to get him right-minded in the center of the bed and understand what the promises really mean to somebody versus what I want. And I guarantee you that I never heard from Laura, and I don't think I ever need to. And that's the clincher in this deal. This thing isn't a self-made program, thank God for that. But I tell you, there are so many stories that I could reveal to you that just keep reinforcing what sobriety means to anybody like me, who drank like me and did what I did, you know?
When I play the tape all the way through, when I really look at what's happened, where I've been, and where I've become, I was no good whatsoever with alcohol, and that's a bottom line. I never struggle anymore to be free from alcohol. But I do want to tell you that my biggest hope and my biggest fact of AA way of living is that I no longer need to live with inner conflict. For me, this alcoholic, it's not about praying the drink away every day anymore. It's about praying myself out of the way. So with that, I want to thank you for a great evening, and I'll see you later.